Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, how Sondheim and Lapine went into the woods with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, Joshua Ellis, Broadway press agent.
Once upon a time.
Joshua Ellis created, developed, and executed the public relations for Into the Woods, along with dozens of other Broadway and off-Broadway productions, including David Merrick's 42nd Street, Lena Horne's The Lady and Her Music, August Wilson's Fences, Yul Brynner in The King and I, Sandy Duncan in Peter Pan, Frank Langella in Dracula, The Elephant Man, Mornings at Seven, Big River, and seven productions with the Royal Shakespeare Company, including The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby. Simultaneously, he was the press representative for the Roundabout Theater Company and later on, director of communications for the La Jolla Playhouse. For 2 years, he did publicity for Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus, and for 5 years, he was Barry Manilow's personal press agent. He was on the founding steering committee of Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, and in 2017, his show, Call My Publicist, The Starry Education of a Broadway Press Agent, won 2 United Solo Theater Awards. Let's start at the very beginning. Before Into the Woods came onto the scene, tell me about your experience. I know you were already a press agent, as they used to say in the old days, by trade. But even just as a lover of musical theater, what was your relationship to Stephen Sondheim before Into the Woods?
I grew up in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And my first experience with Sondheim was the tryout of Anyone Can Whistle. So that was 1964.
Yeah.
And I thought it made no sense. And I thought you had to be more grown up to understand it. But then at the end of the show, the audience seemed to not understand it either. So it made me feel a whole lot better. It was very confusing. I had no idea what it was about. I was keenly aware of the fact that there were three leads who were not particularly comfortable as musical theater stars. Remember, this is like the only town that it tried out. And this is Angela Lansbury's first time doing a musical. And there were two other shows in Philadelphia at the same time where the performers really knew how to do it. And the other two shows were Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand and High Spirits with Beatrice Lilly and Tammy Grimes. That was the context. And I thought, well, they're really good. You know, they know how to do a musical. And these three people, I thought, didn't. So besides it being confusing, it was also not particularly well done.
Did you not have any sense of like, well, if Angela Lansbury keeps at this, she could do something good in musicals?
I wish I could say yes, but I can't.
Wow. All right.
I also saw her first performance as Mame, also in Philadelphia. And what's astonishing about her is that, and she has spoken about this, you can see it on YouTube, that she had to learn how to be Mame, not to play how to play Mame, but how to be Mame. And she had all the acting stuff down, but she didn't know how to carry a musical. It was more like, I'll get from this scene to this scene to this scene. And in the process of going from Philadelphia to Boston to New York, she absolutely got it.
Mm.
That first performance, if I was a producer, I'd have been shitting myself. It was so clear that Beatrice Arthur and Frankie Michaels, who played younger Patrick, were Winter Garden ready.
Yeah.
Angela Lansbury wasn't.
Mm.
But by the time I went to the Winter Garden, oh, was she ready? Okay. She really, and she said she had to learn to be a star. And that's what she learned in Philadelphia and Boston. Okay. So she really did not have star quality.
No.
Although, you know, I'm looking at it through the eyes of a 15-year-old. So it's how accurate is it? But yes. I did have theatrical instincts. I mean, I knew when I was seeing good stuff.
Okay, well, so the show didn't make sense, and the three leads were not ready to carry a musical and Anyone Can Whistle.
Yeah. But
did you have some sense of the songs being of a high quality?
No.
No. So what was, when did you come to be a fan of Stephen Sondheim's?
Oh, that's much, much later. Okay, so we'll have to go through. Okay, there's Do I Hear a Waltz?
Wow.
So, you know, and he's only half the team creating it. And then yeah. I also saw the national tour of Forum. So I got to see him in his more audience-pleasing mode.
Did that the audience members that were pleased not include Joshua Ellis among their number?
No. I had a really wonderful time at Forum.
But weren't sold on the score?
Part of it, but not all the way through. No, yeah. I mean, I love Comedy Tonight. I mean,
yeah,
Jeff loved that one. But I mean, I'm not sure I got to appreciate it right away.
Cool.
And then we leap to, I guess, Company.
Yes. And
the context is I'm 21 years old, and I live in Philadelphia, and it's sophisticated and very New York-y. And I do not understand it.
Mm.
But differently than I didn't understand Anyone Can Whistle.
Yeah.
It seemed like the audience was laughing at stuff and I had no idea what they were talking about. You know, every
yeah.
time I see him, I think of the Seagram's building.
Yeah.
I've never heard of the Seagram's building.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and I thought, he's 35 years old, for goodness sake. I mean, can he make up his mind? But of course, I was looking at 35 from the other end, you know? So I saw it really early in its run. Dean Jones was still in it. The whole cast was in it. And I admired it, but I didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, I kept seeing it back at the Alvin, and then tours and stuff and summer stock. So, and obviously the cast album, and it all started when I started to learn about it is when I started to fall in love with it.
When did you move to New York City?
1973.
So Company had already closed when you got here.
But I mean, if you live in Philadelphia, New York is not that far away.
I mean,
I was here every 10 minutes.
Right.
So, I saw everything.
So had you already fallen in love with Company before Follies opened?
Oh, yes. And I say, oh, yes, because by this time, I'm like, well, how can I really show my cred about really loving Sondheim? And two friends and I got tickets to see the first performance of Follies.
Mm.
The big bonus being that you could see Angela Lansbury and Pretty Bell that afternoon and Follies that night. So we saw Follies as virgins, which is to say we knew absolutely nothing about it other than a reunion of ex-Follies girls. I mean, we didn't know about the girls upstairs. We didn't have historical background. So what we saw was like the first time that they were doing Who's That woman in front of an audience. I mean, like a paid audience.
Yeah.
And we were just blown away. Like totally blown away. And I wrote him a fan letter, and so did the two friends I went with. And we found out what room he was staying at the hotel, and we slid it under the door.
Wow.
Lest it gets lost in the mail. And my two friends got replies from Sondheim, and I did not.
Oh.
On both of their replies, he wrote, "Please extend my gratitude to Mr. Ellis, who did not have the foresight to give me his return address." So from the very start, I was learning lessons from Stephen Sondheim.
Yes, you were.
But that was like, okay, duly noted, you know, you stick a letter under a door. I don't think of like putting the return address on. It's not like it had a stamp. You know, it was just,
yeah,
we were just kids. I mean, that's what we did. Okay. So, and I was crazy about Follies. Again, I wasn't so sure about the relationships because I think they're pretty more mature relationships.
Yeah.
But I love the showbiz of it. Mm. And I love the staging of it. And it was all glamorous.
Yeah.
In my mind's eye, I have constructed a Follies that has Can That Boy Foxtrot and I'm Still Here. Because I like them both. So I just conveniently put them both into the show. In my mind's eye, they're both in the show.
Listen, Carlotta should have two songs. I'm with you.
I'm all with it. Okay, and then I really liked Uptown Downtown more than Lucy and Jesse.
Mm.
And I loved her costume more because she had a pleated dress. And when she spun around, the pleats, the inside of the pleats were a different color. So the dress was as schizophrenic as she was, which I thought was just a brilliant touch. But it was more glamorous, Lucy and Jesse. But I thought, boy, Florence Klotz really gets this. She's like, her design is a metaphor for the show. You know, how astonishing is that to behold?
So yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, by that time I was like clearly in fan land, you know. And then the same two friends and I did the same thing with A Little Night Music. So by this time we were like ready to join the parade.
And were you already working as a press agent at that point?
No, that was 72. Is that right? Or am I wrong? Is that
That's 72? Right.
72?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I moved in 73. So,
oh, pardon me.
My last bit of looking at the whole Broadway scene through a big glass window and hoping to someday be on the other side of that window. But
yeah.
Very much, you know, and I wasn't one of those, you know, I'm going to call him Steve, though I've never met him and he's never asked me to call him Steve kind of. He was just Stephen Sondheim, you know, Mr. Sondheim and not Steve.
He was
Stephen Sondheim.
I get it. Yeah. So then you lived here when A Little Night Music opened.
Yes.
And did you fall in love with that?
Not at first. I think that took a little time too. It wasn't like, I wasn't like a fan, you know, I was an appreciative person.
Yes. And then, were you immediately working as a publicist from that moment?
Well, you have to apprentice for 3 years.
So were you immediately apprenticing for a public
Astonishingly school? Fast, yes.
Yeah.
My first apprentice musical was Mac and Mabel. So I got my first taste of David Merrick, Jerry Herman, Michael Stewart, Garrett Champion, all at once, not to mention Robert Preston and eventually Bernadette Peters.
Oh, but, right, because she did not begin the process as Mabel.
Oh, no, she was Mabel number three.
And the first it was, wait, let me see if I can guess. I think I know this. It's like, was it Penny Fuller?
No, Penny Fuller was spoken to about it, but she was never cast in it. And Penny is now a friend, so we have talked about this.
Ah, yes.
Okay, so so I don't count her as the three. I only count the three that were actually in a rehearsal room.
And so, okay, who was that?
Marcia Rodd.
Marcia Rodd.
Yes. And actually, I'm saying the wrong thing, because she was not in the rehearsal room. She was on my tip sheet to be at the first rehearsal. But when we actually did the event, it was Kelly Garrett who was there in the room.
Huh.
With Merrick not telling us why.
Interesting. I'm
handing out press releases and what?
I don't know Kelly Garrett.
Oh, she had like, I think her big show on Broadway was she did a review of Sammy Kahn's material.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't last long either.
So, okay. Well, then you...
Okay. So anyway, yes, it takes a certain amount of time to get into the union. And and you have to work on a show that runs a certain amount of time. So if you work on Mac and Mabel closes, you haven't gotten all of the weeks you need for that year. So you need to find another show that you can leap onto and get credit for that one. And that one, luckily for me, was Pippin. Not the original, okay, the original production, but not the original cast. Some from the original cast, some not. So anyway, and then I got into the union.
And did you work closely with Bernadette on Mac and Mabel?
No.
No.
Although, okay. When my mother died, I found some old letters, and like I wrote, like, I just came home from an interview at Sardi's with Bernadette Peters and Eugenia Shepherd. Do you remember Eugenia Shepherd?
No.
She was the fashion editor and writer at the New York Post. Okay. And even though it was just the Post, she was a big trendsetter.
Huh.
I mean, her obituary in the New York Times would make you think Eugenia Shepherd was at the New York Times. So she was a big deal.
Okay. Yeah.
Clearly, with no lasting reputation. Other than she's a lyric in a song called Haute Couture in Skyscraper.
Oh. That's Frances Cernan.
Do you have the album of Skyscraper?
I think I did back in the day.
But you don't have the CD like ready to like go, oh, Josh made me want to listen to Haute Couture.
Well, I'm sure I can find it online.
Okay, I'm just saying, to me, fame is getting your name as a lyric in a Broadway show. You know, I mean, yeah. I think that was like, I remember like meeting certain people and going, you know, they were mentioned in Drop That Name and Bells Are Ringing, you know, so that they must be famous.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, that is something.
So anyway, yeah. So, but I didn't have real dealings with her. At first it was a short run and the press was far more interested in Robert Preston.
But did you have a sense this is a great talent? She will be a big star.
She was fantastic from her first performance.
Mm.
And it was the perfect match of actor and role. And as David Merrick said in his David Merrick voice, has that broken wing quality we've been looking for all along.
Mm.
It did seem broken. Even when she was doing the up numbers in Act One, there was a certain vulnerability about her. That was ultimately, they did, I don't think that the creators knew what to do with it, but she got it.
Yeah. Well, she had that I Won't Send Roses reprise and Time Heals Everything are both so vulnerable and beautiful.
Gorgeous. Just gorgeous. But, you know, but the ending is like, I used to joke about the ending. It was as if Dolly came down the staircase at Harmonia Gardens and she's sitting there at the table with Horace and has a stroke and drops dead. Okay, you just don't want it to happen that way. Okay? So she had, it was such a bad ending for her, which was, you know, it's, you don't want the lady who did those songs, not to mention, look what happened to Mabel in Act One.
Yeah.
And Mabel comes in the room in Act Two.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want her to die.
No, absolutely not.
Like, it's not a, I don't know. It was
no two ways about it. Yeah. So, okay, well, getting off of Jerry Herman and back to Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah.
So you had scant experience with Bernadette, but you came to love her work, at least. And then a couple years later, not many Sondheim shows later, she is working with Stephen Sondheim and Sondheim's new collaborator, James Lapine, on Sunday in the Park with George.
Right. Now, I have to bring up something that I don't like to bring up, but I will bring it up nonetheless.
What's that?
I was the original press agent of Sweeney Todd.
Oh.
Fired after the first day of rehearsals.
You know, people are always asking me if I'm on Ozempic, and let me tell you, I do not mind them asking me that. But I'm not on Ozempic. They especially ask me that when they see me eating dessert, or desserts, or all the crap I eat when I'm out. But my secret is that when I'm home, when I'm by myself, I'm eating Factor. Factor sends me restaurant-quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever I am. No prepping, no cooking, no cleanup except for, like, my fork. And now you can enjoy Factor Meals, too. Go to factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 and use code giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off. That's code giantsinthesky50 at factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Wow.
So, to say that Harold Prince and I were not on the same page barely covers the topic. So,
what was the disagreement between you two?
I mean,
was it personal?
I'll tell you exactly what it was, okay?
Yeah.
I had worked with David Merrick for a while by then, and David Merrick and I discussed everything together.
Mm-hmm.
So, I figured, well, it's, why should, I'm not going to be shy with Hal Prince.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to be asked, would you mind if I suggest something? You know, I just discussed it. And I don't think that he liked anyone who questioned his decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And
even though your job was to work with him on the press campaign for the show.
He wanted a yes person.
Ah.
And that's who he had. He had Mary, Mary Bryant, show after show, and that's who he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be a bitch about Mary Bryant, but she was never hired by any other producer, so it's something about she gave him total and complete faithfulness, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The joke in the business was every time Hal Prince calls, she stands up before she answers the phone and salutes him. So, I couldn't compete with that.
Yeah.
I'm going to break this really brief, okay? Because
yeah.
I got invited to do another show with Hal Prince about 10 years later. And I thought, well, I'm not going to get fired from this show again. I'm going to just meet him and see if we can work things out. And if we can, great. If we can't, well, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the original Kiss of the Spider Woman, the one that was at Purchase.
Yes, with Lauren Mitchell.
Right. So I met with Hal Prince and I said, well, here we are, X number of years later. You know, I sensed that you wanted everything done your way without mm-hmm. question. And he said, exactly. And I said, so you don't want me to say anything or make suggestions? He said, exactly. I said, well, okay, I'd like to propose something.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to watch Hal Prince direct the show. I would like to be able to come to any rehearsal I want to come to. I will not make suggestions. I will be in the back. I will simply watch.
Wait, were you making like artistic suggestions about the show on Sweeney Todd?
No, I was before the first fucking rehearsal.
Yeah.
Hey, no. I just thought by this time in my career, I want to watch the process.
Yes.
I want to see the process of Hal Prince directing a show.
Totally.
And my entree, I mean, I'm not going to get any other entree than this.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going to ask them. And no, the suggestions I made were things like, when do we do press day on TV?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
No, I mean, no.
Your job. It was your job to make those suggestions.
Right.
I'm on your side.
Making press short suggestions, not, oh, what about if Mrs. Lovett, blah, blah, blah. No, of course I wouldn't do that. Jesus. Okay. So, anyway, so he said yes.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating experience. And I'm glad that we made peace. And it was like, okay, fine. You know, I didn't get Sweeney Todd, but I did, in fact, get Into the Woods, which was a big, at the time, a bigger commercial success.
Okay, well, Sweeney Todd, were you bitter after that had happened?
Oh, only for like 30 years.
Well, in much less than 30 years, Sondheim was working with a new collaborator in James Lapine on Sending
Right, of course I did. It wasn't, he had nothing to do with that. Or at least as far as I know, he had nothing to do with me getting fired. So why
Sondheim,
did I,
right.
Right, it was about Hal Prince.
Sure. But so then Sondheim had a new collaborator and was working on this in a very different vein on this show. I'm curious how you felt about Sunday in the Park with George.
I guess by this time I'm more discerning about how the audience liked it. Not just I'm now more like I can't turn off the press agent button, as it were.
Yeah.
Get through the eyes of a press agent.
Yeah.
And I sense that it was an excellent artistic success that was not really going over very well with a majority of the audience.
And
I was keenly aware of that discrepancy.
Then when did you become aware that there was a thing called Into the Woods?
Let's see. I was working on Big River with the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to be their next big show.
Yeah.
And they did not just automatically give me the show.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pitch myself to do it, which meant that if I wanted to do it, I'd have to go to San Diego and see it on my own dime and present an idea of how I would publicize and market the show. Which is what I did. And it all happened for me at the Saturday matinee I saw it at the Old Globe.
Yeah.
And again, I'm very aware of children's audience response. And I realized who's having the most fun at this Saturday matinee? Kids.
Mm-hmm.
They are having the best time. And I am pretty sure that they were not little Stephen Sondheim fans.
You know,
they were just kids.
Yeah.
And they loved it. They got it. They mm-hmm. laughed at the right places. They understood the pieces that some that we thought needed to be explained. We were afraid that it wouldn't be explained enough for anyone's audience, let alone children. So I thought that if I got the job, it needed to be a two-pronged marketing and press creation.
Mm-hmm.
One is for like the diehard Sondheim fans, the ones who get the advanced story in the New York Times, the homage to Sondheim.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one was, hey, this show is fun. This is, you can really enjoy it. The subtext of that is, you'll have more fun at this than you did at Sunday in the Park with George. We didn't say that, but that was between us what the subtext was.
Was that something you were able to discuss with your team?
Yes, because we had already worked together on Big River.
Mm-hmm.
Again, one of those shows that I would say it was not instantly a New York favorite. It worked its way in, but it wasn't an easy sell, particularly mm-hmm. pre-opening. So, we talked about it, and I wasn't denigrating the show. I'm just saying it's like we have to make people know that they can relax and enjoy this one. It's delightful.
And who were the people you were having those conversations with? I assume it was the Dodgers, Michael David and Rocco
Landisman.
Yeah.
Sherman Warner, Nancy Coyne from Sereno Coyne,
mm-hmm.
Ed Strong. It wasn't that big a room, you know, it was the conference room at Sereno Coyne.
Were you the only publicist?
I mean, did I do it on my own?
Yeah.
No, I had a whole staff.
That all worked for you and other shows also?
Uh-huh.
Because, for
example, like 42nd Street was still running.
Right, right. So you had to have a big office.
You know, like, people think, oh, you work on this show, and then you work on this show. I mean, you're president.
No.
On all of them, and they're coming and going, and they're opening and closing, and so forth, so...
And, but Big River had closed.
Oh, yeah.
So the Dodgers could focus on Into the Woods.
Right. And I can't remember, they had other shows too, but I can't remember like where Gospel at Colonus fit into mm-hmm. that.
Right.
Okay. So, anyway.
So now.
I pitched it to them as I think that this will actually be easy and fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no reason why it can't be fun to do. Why must we make it serious? Because it's a Stephen Sondheim musical, therefore it must be treated entirely seriously. I mean, yeah. No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean you disrespect it. It means that you find ways within it mm-hmm. to make it accessible. Although, to be honest with you, I had no idea how hugely accessible it was or was going to be in the years to come. Mm. I mean, that I got the fact that children who were brought to the theater will love it, but I had no idea, like, in one day there would be, Disney would produce a movie version of it, that
right.
children in schools do Into the Woods Junior. And they love it because they know it. They're not going, oh yeah, Bernadette, you know. They're just going, we like the characters, or mm-hmm. I played the baker, you know, that kind of thing. You know, it had like a kind of, oh, I played Curly in Oklahoma kind of thing.
Yes.
It's much more accessible than I ever imagined at the time.
But you did think that there was a potential for it to be more accessible than previous Sondheim shows, and you were going to market you said a two-track strategy to take.
Right. I mean, I remember specifically saying to Rocco, I have nothing to do with the quality of the show, but I'm pretty sure that I can make it into a hit. And that's, I don't mean that in an ego way. I meant like, I think we have the tools by which we can do this, not, oh, hire me because I have this magical solution.
Yes.
But it was, when you work with people and they're in a collaborative nature, you can say things like that and it makes the conversations get better and better. Because one of those people said, do you have anything to do with the boot that was hanging, you know, from the side of the
floor?
Okay. It was not my idea, okay? It was definitely Michael David's idea, okay? And I don't like to be one of those people like I was in the room, therefore I created it kind of thing. Okay? But I do believe that I was the one who said, what can we do to make this fun? And the idea that you would walk up to a theater and see a big boot hanging off the side of the theater, and you saw, it was a funny boot because you saw the other piece of boot on top of the theater, so it looked like the giant was literally coming off the marquee. And it was fun, and it became kind of like a New York landmark.
Yeah.
And that's what you want. So you end up with other people doing pictures in front of it, or remember they did a commercial, not the show, like somebody created a photograph of it. And that became like a set, like if you went to like a souvenir place, where there were all those Broadway ones, you know.
Yeah.
Like independent, it wasn't like our merch. It was like New York merch.
Totally.
And that's, you know, and when that happens, you know that you're in a different realm.
Yeah. Now, it seems to me like that's an idea that David Merrick himself could have been proud of.
Well, I have to say that David Merrick inspired me to do a lot of outrageous things.
Yeah.
Because it was David Merrick. If you have, and I would say, I could give him 10 ideas and he'd like one.
Yeah.
But if I gave him 10 a week, that's still, we had a backlog of like.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was the kind of person who, if you gave him an idea, he would like, build it up. Yeah. And wasn't afraid to spend money, because sometimes you have like a producer who goes, yeah, well, if it's publicity, I want to spend zero on it.
Right.
David Merrick was like, no, if we spend this amount of money, we'll get more publicity. So anyway, so that was the goal was joy.
Yeah.
And it was a joyful experience to work on.
What were there any other sort of quote unquote crazy ideas in the promotion of Into the Woods besides the boot?
I'd rather you talk to Nancy Coyne about it, because yes, the radio and TV commercials were deliberately so.
Mm.
And Stephen was in on them.
Mm.
But I don't want to tell her story. I'd prefer you to speak to her and get her version of the story.
Were there, we talked about David Merrick, obviously, in this context, but another big thing that was happening in Broadway in this era was the British invasion. And in the season before Les Mis, in the season before Into the Woods, Les Miserables had opened, which is one of those really long, you know, running, while they didn't have the boot on the theater, their logo all over the city was, you know, kind of in that spirit. Was there anything like that done with Into the Woods?
I'm thinking that it's how we did the pictures for the show and how the visual representation of it. And how, like, James was pretty terrific about letting me stage the photo call. It was not the show. It was, I needed to get all five of the people above the set, above the title, into a picture, and they both had two separate identities. So it was like all five of them and all five of them, but as different characters. Okay. And that doesn't exist in the show. It doesn't, they're not, and if they were, they'd be too far apart and all that kind of stuff. So it was like stuff like that. And you go, well, what's the benefit of that? Okay. Well, when they finally did the TV version, okay, one of those pictures is on the cover of the box.
Yes.
You know, so how is it a practical tool? It's a practical tool because you want all of them. And you don't go, oh, it's a fabulous scene. It's the dramatic piece of the show. And you go, but Bernadette's not in it. I mean, you know, put her into the fucking picture, you know? And James was fine with that. Some directors are not so fine with that.
Interesting. Well, I love those photos of the original Into the Woods production. So I'm so happy that that was...
They're all posed.
Yeah.
But they had to be done posed like David Merrick taught me to do it. They can't look like they're waxworks. Okay? We have to get them into character so when you shoot it, even if it's not a moment in the show, they're not just posing like it was a penny arcade and you put the quarter in, we get all five people from into
now,
the quarter.
What do you say to the actors in that photo shoot to achieve that?
I have a million different things. Okay. Yeah, I have done it so many times.
I want all your tricks, Josh.
But you know, like I'm standing on stage. Okay. My favorite was Mornings at 7. Okay. Yeah. Because they really, the women just, I'm going off on so many tangents. Okay.
Yeah.
The women really loved each other and treated each other like sisters, but as the characters as sisters. So they didn't like me intruding upon making them move to a different place. They would be like, but we're not, I never get on Essie's porch, you know, that kind of thing. And so I got them all on the porch and Nancy Marchand said, well, what do you want us to do? And I said, I'm going to do my damnedest to make you laugh. And she said, well, I'll do my damnedest not to. So it was like this little contest. And there was a picture from that. And I go, it is my absolute favorite Mornings at 7 picture. Not because I came up with it, but because Nancy, like you just had to give her enough to make her do whatever she did better than anyone else. But she would then say, well, it just happened. And you go, well, no, you're a wonderful actress and you made it happen. But she would go like, no. But if you looked at the picture, you'd go, I mean, something was happening and you can tell it in their eyes because if their eyes shine, it's a really good picture. If their eyes don't shine, the picture's not doing its job. Mm. Anyway, but that's, it's a tangent, but...
But I mean, so what would be the Into the Woods version of that?
There's a picture of Bernadette kind of... I'm doing this from memory now, but she's like talking down to the people.
Yeah.
The whole group, and then she's above them. Okay? Yeah. But the only way to shoot that is to make Martha Swope even higher than she is. So it was like ladder upon, we don't have a larger, we need height. Martha can't shoot it from below and have it look like she's shooting it from above. It's only interesting from above.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
But, totally.
Okay. Now, we talked earlier about the logo of the show.
Yeah.
Should we talk about that now?
Please.
Okay. Again, this is like, I can take credit for suggesting something, but the execution was absolutely out of my hands. Okay. I brought into the ad meeting the original logo of Funny Girl, which is my favorite theater logo, because the title is the show. Okay, and the show is the title. I mean, the letters Funny Girl or her dress and the arms sticking out. You know, it's totally integrated. And I said, well, my favorite kind of logo is one where the title is, in fact, the logo. As opposed to, like, separate letters. And like, Blow Dolly is a fabulous logo. I'm not saying it's not. It just happens to be my favorite logos are the ones that are integrated into the artwork. And it was Heidi Landisman who came up with the idea of having the trees. I mean, she literally drew it.
Yeah.
And then Serino took it and turned it into something else. And the little people that are standing underneath the big S.
Yeah.
Were from a different piece of artwork that they moved over to it.
Oh, like another, just for everyone listening, Heidi is one of the producers of Into the Woods, but she also is a designer of other shows. And a set designer. She did not design the set for Into the Woods, but she did design the poster artwork.
Correct.
And
clarifying that, yes.
And it so when you say that she moved the characters over from another piece.
No, she didn't. The ad agency did.
Does that mean that there was a different attempt among the many attempts that was presented at a meeting and one of them featured those characters and then they were sort of cut and pasted onto this one?
Yes.
Interesting. And so you got your way because the one that they
went... I got my way is such a pretentious way to refer to it, okay? All I did was make a suggestion based on a personal preference.
Well, you must have been happy. That's all I'm saying. Well,
of course I was happy.
Yeah.
But, you know, but only because, literally, because it did what it needed to do. And I know, and this is, again, Merrick stuff, can you appreciate it across, like, when you see it at a train station,
yeah,
and it's four tracks over, can you still read it?
Yeah. You know,
it's very legible. It's a very useful logo.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not just looking for something that looks good in the producer's bathroom, you know, but which is where most window cards end up.
Yeah.
It's a tool in our toolbox.
Talk to me about, we discussed your first experience with Bernadette Peters, which was on Mac and Mabel, where you said that the sort of energy publicity wise was much more focused on Jerry Herman and Robert Preston and Gower Champion and David Merrick. Here you are, I guess it's like, you know, 25, give or take, years later. And the biggest star, other than, I guess, Stephen Sondheim on Into the Woods, is Bernadette Peters.
Right.
And so how did that, when you were talking about these two tracks, one is the sort of Sondheimness of it, and the other is the sort of family fun times of the show. How did the sort of publicity for this Golden Globe Award winning, you know, Hollywood and Broadway leading lady Bernadette Peters figure in?
Okay, first of all, she was the last one to join the Broadway cast.
Yeah, right, weeks before they started rehearsals.
Right. So it wasn't like we had a long-range plan.
Yeah.
Bernadette Peters comes in. When she came in, it seemed to be a foregone conclusion that we were going to treat it like an ensemble cast, or at least ensemble stars, so that she was not just Bernadette Peters. She was Bernadette. She was the person who got mentioned first, but she's not the only person above the title. I mean, she's sharing it with a group of people who play a group of characters.
Yeah.
I think that we treated it more like an ensemble. And the fun part is, like, when do you release pictures of her as the witch?
Right.
You know, and you go, well, if you distribute them too early, you're giving away the show. And I'm very big on, like, don't give away the show with pictures outside the theater. If people get married in Act Two and you see them married, don't stick the picture outside. It's giving away the plot. You know,
yeah.
Spoiler. So it was like we did not use the pictures of her as the witch until after post-opening.
Post-opening. And so before then, you had pictures of her in the glamorous look from Act Two, or just her headshot, or what?
Oh, no, no, the glam pictures, you know, from, you know, when she's looking great.
Yeah. But you didn't do the old crone photos until after opening.
No. Or maybe I'm trying to think, did we? No, I don't think we did. But I could be wrong, and I'd say, okay, I just forgot. You know, it's been 36 years.
Now, let me ask you a question. How much before Bernadette was cast were you hired as the press agent for the show?
Pretty long time before.
So were you involved in that summer workshop right before rehearsal started?
I went to it, but I wasn't involved in it.
But you saw Betty Buckley as the witch.
Yeah.
And so, first of all, just from a professional standpoint, you talk about Bernadette being billed first, but being one of five people above the title and not, you know, the star in a sort of exclusive way. Was that equally true with Betty when the idea was that she would play the witch, or did it shift at all?
I have no idea. Because when you do a workshop, you're not exactly planning billing yet. You know,
except that it was just a couple weeks before previews started.
Okay. All I can say is I don't remember it being coming up as an issue.
And what do you remember about Betty's performance? Do you remember it being different from Bernadette's in any specific ways?
I want to be honest with you. I don't remember much about it. And I don't know why, but I don't.
Do you not remember much about that workshop at all, or just Betty in specifics?
I am pretty sure that I knew the show so well from the old Globe.
Yeah.
And I just don't remember. I mean, I don't want to give you false information. I just don't remember.
Okay, so taking Betty and the workshop out of the equation, having seen the show at the Old Globe, where it was really an ensemble show, and Ellen Foley was the witch, and then you get the job, and it's going to Broadway, and Bernadette Peters is going to play the witch. Were you not at all tempted to want to make it about Bernadette being a star? Wasn't that like a real, piece in your arsenal, in your toolkit, a feather in your cap, a jewel in the crown?
No, because you go, what's your plan here? Okay. If you're thinking of it as an ensemble, and she and her personal press agent buy into the fact that this is what we want to do, then it works like magic. It's easy. And I'm pretty sure that is exactly what's happening with Merrily We Roll Along now. Okay, do you think Stephen Colbert really wanted all three stars of the show last week? Or was it, last week, okay?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that they probably, this is just my guess.
I mean, yes.
This is just like me.
Just your years of expertise.
The old talking to old Ben, you know, going and saying, okay, well, of course they want Harry Potter. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's the given. Okay.
Yeah. And
I'm pretty sure that they probably said, if you want him, you have to take the other two. And that's not an uncommon decision to make in the theater when you're working with somebody who's incredibly generous of spirit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen when a person is ungenerous of spirit. Put it that way. But Bernadette's she's just a pro. Mm. And she did it because of Sondheim and Lapine. What are we thinking? That the script just happened to like come across her desk and she just happened to read it? I mean,
it's right.
She's already Bernadette Peters, and nor do I think as a press agent that I am going to, as you called it, like the feather in the cap and all that kind of stuff. She's already what she is. She's already a star. So use her when you can. Use her when you can solo, if that's in its best interest. But for the most part, make it a group effort.
But like, so, I mean, I get when, like, if I put myself in the shoes of the Merrily We Roll Along publicist, and the Colbert Show says, hey, we'd love to book Daniel Radcliffe. And the publicist says, well, we'd really like you to take all three stars, right? You know, and maybe they even play hardball and say it's that or nothing because it's better for the show to have all three stars. But certainly there are going to be opportunities where you don't get to send them all, where you have to, it's better for the show to get some publicity, and they're only interested in Bernadette Peters.
Right. And if it's the show is selling out, like Merrily We Roll Along, you can play hardball.
Right.
They know if you need to sell tickets. You know, it's
But Into the Woods was not selling out.
Right, but it was an easy thing at the time to do some Bernadette Peters solo stuff and some ensemble stuff. But we did enough, quote unquote, ensemble stuff that those people in the ensemble weren't exactly left on the sidewalk.
No, it helped that Joanna Gleason was having a star-making personal triumph in her role and other people.
She didn't get the Tony nomination and award because she was just a good team player.
No, but that was all later. I mean, the show opened in November and the Tonys and the nominations were in April. So that's a long stretch where you might know how great she is, but you're selling the show based on what the audience knows coming in, right?
No, you're selling the show on what the press knows about it.
Okay, so
they are part of it.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like I had to say, ooh, keep your eye on, you know, on Joanna Gleason. She's the one you should be looking at. First of all, it would be horribly unfair to do that.
Yeah.
And denigrating to the other actors who were in it. And when a person has a star-making role, the press agent can help along, you know, you move it along, but you don't quote-unquote make them a star. You know,
But if the more energy there is around their performance, aren't you taking advantage of that to the show's benefit to promote it wherever
you're manipulating all the time to say, how can I do this the best given this opportunity we have?
Right.
And it could be a telethon because people would go, oh, the telethon. Who wants to do the MDA telethon?
Right.
You know, and I remember, it's like, I remember Yul Brynner. I did not want to do the telethon. And I said, well, okay, I just want to find out what the ratings are. Okay? So I go and I find out that if you do it
at
7 o'clock Eastern time on the Sunday, that is when you will get the best ratings, because at the time, it was on all the channels at the same time. Okay? Mm. So I go back there and I go, well, you know, it does have an audience. I'm making these numbers up, okay? It has an audience of 100 million. Are you sure you don't want to do it? Well, maybe if we do it at 7 o'clock, we can do it. You know, so it's all negotiated. It's what works best under the set of circumstances that you've been given.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part is that, I mean, Joanna knows how to do an interview. Chip knew how to do an interview. They were all, you know, it's like, it's not just that you stick them with an interviewer. That's only half of it. They have to really shine during the interview, where the interviewer goes, well, they were so boring. I mean, you would think that somebody so good on stage could be so boring in their dressing room.
Yeah. So then what happens when you get the information that spring, or whenever you found out in February or March, that Bernadette would be leaving so soon, in fact, before the Tonys?
Well, thank you for reminding me of that, because I didn't remember what the chronology was.
Yeah.
And the energy becomes, okay, first of all, it means that we can't use the same pictures now.
Right.
It's front and center in the other one.
Yeah.
Who is the replacement? Who's the replacement going to be? What's their Sondheim or Lapine connection?
Yeah.
What's unique about that particular thing? And is that worth publicizing? Or in the case, just going, okay, it has its own momentum now. We're not going to talk about it.
So, but did I understand the show did not really have enough momentum that where they could relax? I mean, you had to figure
it
out.
We never could relax.
Yeah. Okay?
This was not one of those. I mean, I've worked on those, you know, just go, well, that's not true. You have to keep spinning it. Okay. It doesn't just spin by itself like a top forever and always. You have to constantly move things along. But she's leaving, so she's leaving, and you deal with the reality of the next person.
Yeah.
I mean, the surprising thing for me with Into the Woods was how glorious Cleo Lane was in the national tour.
Mm.
I mean, she was absolutely astonishing and fabulous. And not to denigrate Bernadette, but
no,
Cleo Lane really delivered the goods. To me, she was I guess I could say she was my favorite, but that's, I don't play favorites, but she was in fact my favorite.
Well, let's assume they're all wonderful in different ways. What is it that Cleo brought to the role that we might not realize, not having seen her do it?
She's instantly a great jazz singer and instantly an earth mother. And the earth mother kind of works in a kind of odd way against character and with character. And she's able to be believably wicked and deliciously wicked. And just her own way, she was not for one second did you go, I never would believe that was Cleo Lane. She was Cleo Lane, but in a way that it's such a juicy role.
And yeah,
the fact is that the person kind of gets to do kind of like, you're introduced one way and then you come out and you're introduced another way. So it's like you get like double entrance. So it's like, oh yeah, well, we really liked her as that character. And now look at her. Which is, they all had that quality. She just had, and Bernadette was just, I mean, face it. When she came out in that low cut dress.
Yeah.
It was like, where does she put them, you know? But and I think I told you the best smelling actress in the history of the theater
is Bernadette.
Yes.
What does she smell like?
The height of spring.
Wow.
I mean she was like you could say you could blindfold me and I'd find her. I mean, it was that unique. She just smelled great. I mean, what do you say? You work on a show, you find little, you know, just like little things. Okay.
Amazing. Okay. And
do you want to talk about writing the playbill? Because the playbill obviously plays a large part.
Please tell me.
Story. Okay. As is Stevens, but Stevens, I can't say it in the past tense yet. As was Stevens' way, he wrote a song for Bernadette Peters really, really, really late in the preview process. So we were out of the rehearsal room. We were already at the Martin Beck. And we had a song called Boom Crunch.
Yeah.
He took it out and he put in Last Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem was that the playbills were already printed.
Ah.
And I thought, well, you know, you could just put a sheet of paper in and say, here's the revised list of songs.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was really, really chintzy. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a new Stephen Sondheim musical.
Yeah.
The first musical since Sunday in the Park with George, the one the Pulitzer Prize and the Tony. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, so no, I am not going to work on a show and stick a sheet of paper in.
Yes.
So I called Playbill and explained what the situation was and said, is there any chance that you can reprint the opening night playbills?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the opening night. You have to have it for all the critics' performances.
Yeah.
Or the opening and the opening and all the second night press and the third night press.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, I'm going to guess, around 10,000 playbills.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really, really expensive proposition.
Yeah.
And it's so late in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So I spoke to Arthur Bursch, the publisher, and explained what the problem was. And he said, we normally would just say no. But because it is Sondheim, we'll make an exception and we will reprint the whole playbill.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, there's no insert. That new page with Last Midnight is in the playbill.
Thank you, Playbill.
Thank you, Playbill. So these are the days before, I guess, faxes. And I spell it all out to the you can hear where this is going.
Yeah.
The typesetter. And it sounds just fine. Okay. So we get to the get to the theater the afternoon of the first critics performance, which I don't remember. I guess it was a Wednesday matinee. It could have been a Sunday matinee for all I know. And there are piles and piles of playbills in the theater. Tied up with twine, mm-hmm. and on top of them is a little sheet of paper that says opening night, which means you, and they do that with every show, or they did then.
Yeah. Because
you know, absolutely, those are the opening night playbills for all the critics' performance.
Don't they have like the gold sticker on front, the front?
Not then.
Not then.
Okay. So I tear open the twine. And I turn the page to the song list, and it says Lost Midnight.
Oh, damn it.
Okay. And I go, so close and yet so far. I think, well, I'm going to have to do something I really, really don't want to do. Call Stephen Sondheim and tell him.
No, no.
Okay, which is not my choice.
No,
but you couldn't
farm that off on someone else. You had to take responsibility.
You know, the name on the office door was the Joshua Ellis office. Oh,
God damn it!
What was required of me? But I
lost midnight.
Okay, so I call him up and say, Steve, there is a problem with the opening night playbills, but I think I have two solutions for it. Okay. Instead of Last Midnight, they've written Lost Midnight in 10,000 playbills. Here's how we can rectify it. This afternoon, might you rewrite a new song for Bernadette called Last Midnight? Lost Midnight. Okay. Or, my staff and I will go to the theater and make the O's into A's with fine point Sharpies 10,000 times. And he says, get out the Sharpies. So that's how you know it's an opening night playbill. And if you would like to, I will resend, because I remember sending it to you last time.
Yes, I have them. That's wonderful.
Okay, so it's like, it's not a made up story. It's
wow.
Like, it really did say Lost Midnight.
Incredible.
So that was like, I think my favorite story out of it.
Broadway history.
Okay. I want to talk about something else about Stephen.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that people really talk about, which is how much a man of the theater he was in all aspects. So, I mean, not just writing the music and writing the lyrics, but it's something that happens on most new shows, though mainly musicals, is when you're in previews, the people who are working on the show stand in the back and watch the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fun. And simultaneously, I suppose when you're in that place and you've seen the show enough times, you react too quickly and you react too loudly. And he very specifically said, when we have the critics in the house, I do not want anyone back there. Now, how many playwrights have I worked with? How many composers have I worked with? How many lyricists? The notion that he was that aware of the whole environment.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just, okay, I want the critics to watch the show. I don't want them to be thinking about, well, why is there so much more applause in the back of the theater?
Yeah.
Or more laughter or more anything. And it is, in fact, anticipatory applause, and it is anticipatory, yeah. or compensatory. Like, oh, if I don't laugh, you won't hear the audience laughing enough.
Right.
So, you think you're doing it to the aid of the show, and he thought it was a distraction. But I yeah. think that kind of attention to detail was just, to me, astonishing.
That had to have been partly a product of his experience on Merrily We Roll Along in the original production.
I'm going to guess it was probably built into him over years and years and years of the shows. I mean, who knows what happened on Allegro? You know, I don't know. I mean, maybe something happened and he picked up on that.
Yeah,
you know, good you're call. Dealing with somebody that has such a long history.
Yeah.
Who knows where they learned all the lessons that they learned about.
Right. It might not even be from his own work. It might be from his young years, as you said, on Allegro when he was Hammerstein's little buddy. Maybe it was when Hal Prince first produced the Pajama Game. Sondheim sat in the back with all the in crowd laughing and they felt he saw the critics looking annoyed. I mean, who knows?
Right. But to me, it's like in a business where I have come to appreciate real pros, the ones who were like, they get it and then they get it on top of getting it.
Yeah.
That's what he was.
Yeah.
Which is not in any way to diminish his contributions in all the other areas, just the fact that he had that going along too.
Yeah. But I guess in a way those things go together, because I think the excellence of Stephen Sondheim has to do with that kind of, I don't want to say perfectionism because that's so trite, but it's a taking responsibility for everything that's being put out there for the audience to experience the show.
Yeah. And the other thing, and I'm not sure if I want to even say this, but I'll say it and you can decide, you know, he threw a party in his townhouse for the cast and company of Into the Woods.
Yeah.
And
it
was pretty early on. And what surprised me is that he was incredibly nice.
Yeah.
But he was so shy with his own guests.
Mm.
And that was my biggest, that like they're your guests in your house. You know, like if like where would the relaxation come if not there? You know,
yeah.
Maybe he just, I mean, no one forced him to throw it. You know, it was his own choice.
Don't you find that in general, though, that some people just don't know how to host a party, like regardless of their intentions of having it, they don't have that gene to play that role in that moment?
No, my experience has been just the opposite.
Really?
I think I've worked with a lot of life of the parties.
I guess you have.
But, you know.
Yeah. I've definitely found
I know.
It.
I mean, I know. I, 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 I mean, even David Merrick, who, by the way, you think, well, boy, if he threw a party for a company, that would be really serious stuff. And on the contrary, he was more comfortable with cast members than he was with anyone else.
Yeah.
He liked being with the chorus. And they liked him. They were not intimidated by him.
No.
So you think, oh, well, I'm just a Corrine in 42nd Street and he's David Merrick, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't it. He was more, you know, of the company. Ditto Richard Rodgers with how he was on the King and I revival in 77. And, you know, it's like, how close would he be to the company? I guess he was of the age where he just liked to spend Wednesday afternoons in the wings watching the show.
Mm.
He had a really warm relationship to the cast.
King and I 77 was Yul Brynner and Constance Towers.
Right.
That's the one that Angela Lansbury went into for a couple of weeks.
Ah, yes.
Your favorite. By then, she was a musical comedy superstar.
I can't begin to tell you the joy it was working with her and what a total and complete pro she was under the worst of circumstances.
Yeah. Okay.
Anybody can be nice when the show is selling out and you're the toast of the town.
Right.
But that was not the case. And she was still gracious and loving and professional and just, I can't begin to tell you how astonishing she was on stage and off stage, but more so off stage, because I was invariably giving her bad news. I mean, how do you feel? Like, I'm the one who has to go in there and say, you know, like she'll say, how's the house tonight? And you go, well, it's a little thin. You know, you mean, what, but like she took it like a pro, and I was like sweating. And she'd say, like, it's okay. It's just okay. You know, we do the show and we enjoy doing it. And that's why we're in this.
And, well, that's professionalism at its core, right?
Yeah. And it spoils you from the ones who were like, can only give a good performance if there is a full house. And if there is, and I work with them too.
Yeah. You want to name any names?
Of course not.
Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, how Sondheim and Lapine went into the woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Look out for episode 35 with Nancy Dussault, Replacement Witch.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.